for an experience like this, it is symbolic in many ways of deeper aspirations, deeper intentions, ways we see the world, ways we see ourselves. When we practice meditation, for most of us, it's not at all about adopting a belief system or trying on someone else's view of the world, whether the Buddha's or anybody else's, but much more about using the tools and the skills that are offered in various systems to see for ourselves more clearly, more truly, what our experience actually is. One of my meditation teachers once said, the moment you sit down to meditate is the most important moment of your meditation. Because in that moment, we are saying something about our belief in change, our conviction that tomorrow doesn't necessarily have to look like yesterday, that there's movement, there's growth. We're saying something about our own potential, not to just be stuck in a rut. We're saying something about caring about ourselves. All of that happens in the moment we sit down or stand up, depending on the form, to actually do the practice. The rest is always changing. There are times when we have great tranquility and peace, times when our practice is incredibly tumultuous and turbulent, and somehow it's all okay. Because what is important is not so much an experience of meditation that we can somehow reapply and then hold on to and say to somebody else, oh, I had a great one, you know. It's not something like that. It's not a commodity. What is important is what is brought forth from our own hearts in the act of doing it. It's the ways that we change. It's the ways that we transform, which are very subtle. It's not what we might think. I'm wearing my yoga shirt. I went to this yoga workshop with my teacher. His name is John Friend. He was doing this intensive workshop in Utah for about a week. And I was absolutely the complete beginner of the group that was gathered there. Everybody could, you know, instantly it seemed, form themselves into those pretzel-like poses, and not only that, but everybody seemed to know the Sanskrit names for all the postures that we were doing, except for me. And one day in the class, John was demonstrating a pose, in the middle of which he made this kind of funny movement and then just went on. So when he came back down out of it, he said to everybody, what happened there? And all these different people kept offering these Sanskrit names for that funny movement. Oh, you were doing a part of this and this asana or that asana, you know. And then finally, John looked at me and he said, what happened there? And I said, I think you fell. And he said, you're right, I fell. And then I began again. He said, that's good yoga. You know, so it's very similar to what I feel about meditation. It's not about assuming something we consider perfect or trying to reinterpret what actually happens in a nicer light with a Sanskrit name. But it's having that kind of heartfulness and that open-heartedness, that ability to begin again, the movement toward balance, whatever extreme we've gone off to, coming back to a greater balance, being able to not be so discouraged when we fall and to lose heart, but instead to have more patience, having a sense of a bigger picture, starting over, coming back. It's things like that, sort of subtle. It would be easier for us, I think, if we could lay claim to meditation as a commodity, because we're awfully used to that. There's some ad, which I haven't seen, but many of my teaching colleagues quote, so maybe you've heard it before from somebody else, where apparently it's an ad for it's a print ad for a Jeep. And this man, let's call him John, because I can't think of his name, is standing in front of the Jeep with piles of stuff everywhere, all around him. And the quotation, the caption reads, "For John to be one with everything, he needs to have one of everything." To buy this Jeep to carry around all your stuff. You know, and that's so much the way we are in every day. It's the way we're trained to be, really. Not just one ad, you know, but many, many things in our society are giving us that message that we don't have enough, we are not enough, we're somehow deficient or incomplete, not good enough, and that we need to acquire objects and Jeeps and people and experiences. We need to acquire them, we need to possess them, and hold on to them. And then we'll be okay. So that is why meditation is actually such a radical activity. It can seem like nothing, you know, like you're sitting down, you're feeling your breath, something like that, repeating a phrase. I mean, it doesn't seem like such a radical thing to do, but it is really radical because it challenges totally all of those assumptions about where happiness is to be found, what we need in this moment or not, and who we are. You know, moving away from the projections and the kind of normal way, the role identification that we move about with in life. Most of us experience our lives as being pretty fragmented, where we may be one person at work and a completely different person at home with our families, or we're filled with loving kindness for all beings everywhere when we're all alone. But it doesn't work that well when we're with other people. Or we're fine when we're with other people, but we're terrified of being alone. Most of us do experience our lives as being kind of divided and scattered in that way, really fragmented. I think of meditation practice as a movement toward wholeness. When I first saw a Buddha image, I grew up in New York City, you know, so not like in a casual way, like in a Chinese restaurant or something, but when I first saw a Buddha image when I went to India, when it was held in some veneration, I would look at the Buddha image and I would think about that, because in my mind, the Buddha symbolized somebody who was a completely integrated human being. Seems to me that the threads of wisdom and compassion guided his life, whether he was alone or with others, whether he was wandering through India teaching or he was being still in one place. He just was who he was, completely. With those threads of wisdom and compassion supporting him, something he could rely on, unbroken, in all kinds of changing circumstances and situations. And that's what I wanted. Maybe more than anything I could articulate at the time when I first went to learn how to meditate, that's what I wanted, was that sense of wholeness. One of the things I love about meditation practice is that the really big life lessons happen in these itty-bitty little packages. The techniques can seem extremely simple, although not that easy to do. And every moment of them is reflective of a bigger truth. So, for example, if we're sitting down with the effort to put our attention on the feeling of the in and out breath, most of us discover it's not 850 breaths before our mind wanders. One, you know, or two, maybe three, maybe five. We're gone. We're just gone. But that movement, first of recognizing that we're gone with some loving kindness instead of our normal habit of brutally judging ourselves, to have some compassion in that moment when we recognize our attention has wandered, to be able to let go of whatever that distraction was, beautiful or challenging, whatever it was, and to gather our attention back to whatever object of concentration we're working with. To let go and gather our attention back is that movement toward wholeness. It's that movement toward a centered being, rather than being so scattered all over the place. So that little act, you know, if like somebody said to you at the end of today, how was your meditation? And you said, well, I sat down, I felt a few breaths, my mind wandered, and I brought it back. That's not that exciting to report, you know. You want to be able to say, well, I was drowning in brilliant white light, or, you know, I levitated, or, you know, I could see into the past, I could see into the future, something like that. But it's really crucial, because right in that little act, that little moment of realizing your attention has wandered and starting over, is a huge amount of truthfulness. See what your experience is. It's a huge amount of skills training to let go instead of berating yourself endlessly. And it's almost like a kind of remembrance. Oh, I can begin again. Bringing your attention back. So that wholeness, coherence, cohesiveness, non-fragmentation is something that we open up to more and more and feel at home in. So we begin to notice how scattered we are a little bit sooner. And we come back, we make that movement toward wholeness of our being. This sounds like nothing, and it can seem like nothing, but a lot's going on just in that simple act. So the meditation may not come with great grandiose flourishes, you know, with these kind of tremendous experiences we've read about or maybe had, you know, at some time or envied in others, but it doesn't matter. Another radical notion in meditation is that it doesn't matter really what your experience is. What matters more than anything is how you are relating to that experience. That's very hard to believe. We can be so object-oriented, so obsessed with that. It's very hard to believe. But it's like my yoga teacher, John, falling and starting over. That's good yoga. You know, what is good meditation? It's having a spirit of awareness, connection, compassion, loving kindness, no matter what is happening. We talk about that in terms of the quality of mindfulness. We say, just be mindful. In fact, if you practice, say, with a Burmese teacher in this particular tradition, very often, what you discover is that, as I discovered as a student, is that no matter what you say to them, they say exactly the same thing back. Were you mindful of it? So you're describing sleepiness or angst or ecstasy or whatever, and they look at you and say, and were you mindful of it? Anything? what do you mean? But there's something to that, that kind of austerity, which is also very liberating. To be able to see, oh yeah, this is the truth of the present moment, how am I with it, is really the essence of the practice, which means you can't fail at it. If you get sleepy, if you get bored, if you get restless, if you have knee pain, it's not a sign of failure. Each may be their particular challenge, that's true. But in and of themselves, they don't mean, oh, you've gone down a real bad road. And just that same way, all of those beautiful experiences that we yearn for aren't necessarily a sign of triumph. It all depends on how we're related to it. So to be with what is, with kind of a clear perception, oh, this is what's happening right now. Not so much a perception informed by bias. Oh, I never liked that, or this shouldn't be, or, you know, so-and-so said they had this for 5 minutes, why do I only have it for 2.5? You know, all of those ways that some kind of bias or prejudice or preconception or grasping or fear come in and distort what we're seeing. So we hardly even know what we're experiencing anymore. This is like an ordinary day. We hardly know what's happening because we're so busy judging it, trying to push it away or hold on to it or comparing it to someone else's experience. And I think that's why we often feel life is just a little bit arid, you know? We don't experience much. Because so quickly all of those concepts come in. So we really don't know. Mindfulness, in a way, returns our experience to us. It's like when the Buddha said, those who are heedful, or those who are mindful, are on the path to the deathless. Well, those who are heedless, or those who are mindless, are as if dead already. It's like, where is it? You know, where is that experience of any moment? Taste or the touch or the smell. It's right here, but we're not. So learning how to actually arrive for our experience and not to be so tremendously caught up in all of that movement of the mind, the agitation of the mind, holding on, pushing away, and really more fully being there. It's also a tremendous expression of love and care for ourselves to open to our lives to be present in that way. Normally we think about ourselves a lot, I think, but not in the sense of real loving kindness or compassion. Usually it's more a kind of self-obsession. Sometimes from very classic texts, especially Tibetan texts, they translate it as self-cherishing, but I don't really think it's self-cherishing as much as kind of self-obsession. You know, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep, it's like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? Do they like me more than they've ever liked anybody else they've ever met? Maybe not. How can I rectify that? You know, or I'm not going to hate me. I'm sure they hate me. You know, it's like, you know, so there's very little sense of genuine connection because we're just wrapped up in that kind of self-preoccupation. I had a wonderful example of that. I think I was here last summer, right? So that was before my book came out, my book Faith came out in paperback, which was in the fall, which sent me out onto another book tour. And I was in Houston. And the tour was going from Houston, I think, to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to Chicago, Chicago to Washington, D.C. I wasn't going to do anything for the book in Washington, D.C., but I was going to land in Washington, D.C. on September 11th, and then I was giving a talk someplace privately, and then going to the National Cathedral to hear the Dalai Lama speak, who was part of the memorial service for September 11th. So I was in Houston, and I picked up my cell phone messages, and I had a message from a friend of mine who was organizing the Dalai Lama's visit to the National Cathedral. And she said, we were going to have a Sri Lankan monk read a passage from some Buddhist text as the introduction to the Dalai Lama, and he suddenly can't come, so I'm wondering if you could do it. And which passage would you use? So I called her back and I said, well, you know, there is a sutta, a text on loving kindness that I would probably use, and, you know, it would be a tremendous honor. But the whole time I was thinking, I don't think I have the right shoes to do this. On my book tour, and I'm traveling like all the time, and you know, it's really a hassle to have, you know, like extra shoes, and I only have like, you know, these really normal looking shoes, not the kind of shoes you want to wear to the National Cathedral if you're introducing the Dalai Lama. But then I thought, well, you know, tomorrow I'll be in Minneapolis, but I'm really busy, I'll be downtown, and the next day I'm going to be Chicago, and, you know, I have the afternoon free, I have to go to the bookstore, so I'll, you know, I'll go out and I'll buy a pair of shoes in Chicago. None of which I said to her, of course. You know. I was thinking that all through. And she said, well, let me just call you back tonight, you know, to confirm. So we hung up, and the whole time I was thinking, let's see, you know, what will I do in Chicago? Will I use a cab to get, you know, I'm like, I have to buy these shoes. And I went through this whole thing, and I didn't pick up my messages yet until like midnight or something like that. And she said, you know, I'm so sorry, but the Sri Lankan monk got another Sri Lankan monk, you know, who's going to do it, so we don't actually need you at all. So I said, okay, you know, now I have to buy her shoes. You know, so I went to Minneapolis, I went to Chicago, and then I flew into Washington, D.C. on September 11th, which was a very, very intense thing to do. I found it quite intense to be on an airplane that morning, flying into D.C. There was tremendous sorrow in the air. It was a very somber sort of experience, both in the Chicago airport and on the flight, landing in D.C., and then I went to give a talk, and, you know, many people that I was speaking to, I had a pretty rough day on September 11th, 2001. They were sobbing, and it was, you know, it was very intense. And I went to the National Cathedral, which is this amazing edifice, you know, with tremendous grandeur. And I hadn't seen the Dalai Lama in a while at that point, so I was filled with the sense of exhilaration in seeing him, and there was the, you know, the grandeur of the place, and the intensity of the day. And he was standing on the stage, and then the Sri Lankan monk came up to read the passage from the text, and all I could look at was his shoes. And I just kept looking at his shoes, thinking, well, those aren't really great shoes. I was really thinking I had to go out and buy a pair of shoes. Then I looked at the Dalai Lama shoes. Those aren't really great shoes either. And it's amazing. It's how, like, the joy and the sorrow and the beauty and the grandeur and the, you know, the intensity of everything shrank down. It's just her shoes. That's how we are. So much of the time, we can be facing a tremendous challenge or in an extraordinary place. And what are our minds doing, you know? It's like, a few weeks ago, I had laryngitis, maybe more like a month ago now, and it was very interesting not being able to speak. I couldn't teach because I couldn't speak, but I was often in relationship to somebody, you know, trying to make an arrangement for something or something like that. And, it was so interesting to be able to watch my mind, because somebody would say something and I would see the perfect response come up in my mind if I could say it. And then there would be the thought, boy, that would be the perfect response, you know? Or wouldn't they think I was witty if I could only say, which I couldn't say? Or, oh no, you know, I can't really show them how completely wrong they are about their point of view. And it's so funny, kind of watching it all and just seeing, because I couldn't just put it into practice, you know, I couldn't say it. Couldn't actualize it, to see how much of that thinking was so self-referential. They would think I was really smart if I could only. So there we are in any given day. Not loving ourselves, but kind of consumed with this kind of relative positioning around life. And meditation is almost like the antidote to that. Not that it doesn't arise, that they're just disclosed. It's a great act of self-disclosure. Not that it doesn't arise, but we've learned how not to be consumed by that. We don't have to just carry it out all the time and live driven by those kinds of considerations every day, every moment. We can learn to see forces arise in our minds and let them go and start over. We can learn how to be more in harmony with what we actually care about. We learn not to judge ourselves so ruthlessly when these old habits do arise, but take delight in the fact that we can have them come up and not be imprisoned. Very radical activity in a very, very simple form. So throughout today, hopefully we'll have a lot of fun in a certain Buddhist kind of way. Some of you may be going to hear Rhonda speak Sunday night. And Rhonda was a very prominent figure in the 60s and 70s, bringing people such as myself, you know, to an understanding of Eastern philosophy and ways of seeing the world. And then later on in the 80s and 90s, around really social change and bringing spirituality into social action and things like that. And he's my old friend. He just coincidentally is here on Sunday. But anyway, he once came to Barrie, where the Insight Meditation Society is, and it happened to be the Buddha's birthday. And my Burmese teacher, Saito Pandita, was there teaching at the time. And a kind of formality around Theravada monks is often, and nuns is often serving them food for lunch, and then just being with them as they eat, and then usually they talk in return. There's some kind of exchange that goes on. So we said to Ramdas, well, why don't you come up to the house where Pandita is, and it's the Buddha's birthday. You know, it'll be some kind of celebration. So what it turned out to be came, and what it turned out to be was like a completely silent meal where we served the monks, and then we sat there and watched them eat, and then they kind of got up and walked away. So Ramdas turned to me and said, you Buddhists really know how to throw a party. That's the kind of fun we're going to have today. But it's that own kind of fun where our effort will be toward not judging so much, but being more wholehearted, being more connected, like actually feeling the breeze, feeling the sunshine, being with our experience, being more forgiving of ourselves when we need to start over. And what one discovers, you know, Jenny really gets to say, but what one discovers is that based on this open-heartedness that comes toward ourselves, comes a very strong connection and care and love for others. So it's not self-preoccupation in that way either. It's really the basis for being able to relate more clearly and truthfully and lovingly toward others. Most of the day we'll spend in silence, although, you know, as Alan said, if you really feel the need to talk, that's fine. You know, just let's try to preserve this area right here. And when we move from sitting meditation to walking meditation, 16 to 18 years old, and some of their parents and some of their teachers all coming together for this retreat, and we were told in making all the preparatory plans, oh, the kids can't be silent. You know, they can't do silence. You know, don't make it silent. And so we didn't. We, much less than here, but we were going to have, you know, some short periods of silence, and then times of speaking, and another short period of silence. And then we were in our staff meetings, we were calling it creeping silence. We would try to introduce a little more each day, you know, like a silent meal, which is a very interesting thing to do, and then, you know, another silent meal. So that's how we introduced the retreat. That's how we organized it and began holding it. And on the second day, one of the kids stood up. He was like a student leader. He was about 18. And he said, we, this group, or this council of leadership, you know, within the student body, we had a meeting yesterday, and we decided we have to be silent. He said, you know, he said, a lot of you might think that silence closes you down, but it really opens you up. It opens you up to perceiving things you might not see otherwise, because we're so caught in chit-chat. You know, all the stupid stuff that we talked about, he said, so we're going to be silent from now on. And it's just like, whoa. It's very much in that spirit. We might think it, you know, closes us down, but it really opens us up to seeing things we might miss because we're so busy. Like me, laryngitis, you know? I got to see things that I might have missed if I had been busy actually making those responses. It created some space to see more acutely, to notice more acutely what was happening in my own mind. So it's very much in that spirit that we undertake the silence, we undertake the discipline of really, you know, putting ourselves into the practice to see what we might discover. Okay, so why don't we take a break? Sound break, for like 10 minutes or so.